culture in these countries is probably not acceptable in the most of these countries. I've been to California before I came to South Carolina. And although both states are in one country, for me, they seem like two different countries on two different continents. We are talking about the same country. So can you imagine 57 countries and making generalizations about all of them because of the culture of one country? The word Islam linguistically means surrender, purity, and peace. And technically, the word Islam is the message conveyed by all the prophets of God from Adam all the way to Muhammad, passing by Abraham, David, Solomon, Isaac, Moses, Jesus, upon all of them be peace. And the essence of this message has always been serve one God and be good to fellow humans and by the same extension to the rest of the creation of God. If you look at the Ten Commandments, for example, the first four commandments talk about serving God alone and worshiping Him alone. From 5 to 10, they talk about being good to fellow humans. Don't kill, don't steal, so on and so forth, which basically means be good to the people. And this is what I mentioned earlier about the essence of the message of Islam, serve God alone and be good to fellow humans. The Muslim Ten Commandments exist in chapter 17 and chapter 6 of the Quran. So what is 5 plus 6 equals N? For someone to be Muslim, they need to do 5 things and they need to have 6 beliefs. So the 5 deeds are, number 1, the testimony of faith, to bear witness that there is only one God and Muhammad is a prophet like all those who came before him. And number 2, to establish the prayers 5 times a day. And number 3, to give charity to the poor. If you keep money in your savings account for a year without touching the money, and you keep over $2,200 in your account, you need to give 2.5% of it to the poor. Number 4, fasting in the month of Ramadan from dawn to sunset. No food, no drink, no intimate relationships with one's spouse during the day. And number 5, the pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca if the person is physically and financially able to. The 6 beliefs are to believe in the Almighty God. Number 2, to believe in His angels. Number 3, to believe in His scriptures. To believe in His messengers and prophets. To believe in the day of resurrection, that all humans who have existed from the beginning of time to the end of time will be resurrected, and every person will be questioned about his or her actions in this life. If they have done good, they will be rewarded. If they have done evil, they will be punished. Nothing happens in this world without the knowledge, the prior knowledge of God. It doesn't force anyone to do anything, and everyone is accountable for his or her actions on the day of judgment. So this is the belief in the divine wisdom. Any act that is done with a good intention in Islam is considered an act of worship. So if you go to school to be a doctor, to save humans, or if you go exercise, do sports, play soccer like me all the time, if you support the Tigers with a good intention, then this is also an act of worship in Islam, like prayers and fasting and charity. One of the main misconceptions about Islam is Muslims worship a different God by the name Allah. And this God is different from Jehovah, the God of the Bible. But this is not true. In every language, there is a different word for God. In Christianity, in English, the word God is used. In French, there is the word you. In Russian, the word Bog is used for God. Can you tell me what language did Jesus speak? Jesus Christ? No, it's not Hebrew.
Amaraya.
He spoke Aramaic. And what was the word he used to refer to God? Not Jehovah. Allah. So the word that Jesus used his entire life to refer to God was Allah, not God, not Jehovah. And what was the word used by Moses to refer to God? Elohim. And there is the word Elohim, which is the plural of Elohim in Hebrew. And the word used by Arabs is Allah. So you have Allah, Elohim, and Allah. The three languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Arabic, are Semitic languages. So you see the similarities. One more thing. All Arabs, Muslim Arabs, Christian Arabs, and Jewish Arabs, use the word Allah to refer to God. So it's not only Muslims. This is the only word we use in Arabic, regardless of our faith, to refer to God. If you take a look at the first passage of the book of Genesis, the Christian Arabic Bible, you see the word Allah highlighted, used 6 times in the first 3 lines. And throughout the Arabic Christian Bible, the word Allah is used thousands of times. You always hear about Sunnis and Shias, and there are different sects in Islam. If you study history, you will know that the difference between Sunnis and Shias is political in nature and not based on religion. Right after the death of Prophet Muhammad in the year 632, there was a major conflict between different groups of Muslims. One group, the majority of them, said that the most qualified, most knowledgeable Muslim should be the successor of Prophet Muhammad to lead the Muslim community. And this group is called Sunni Muslims. The second group was a group of people who said, no, a person from the Prophet's family should lead the Muslim community. And this group, till today, are called the Shia Muslims, and they make up less than 10%. However, Sunnis and Shias go to the same mosque and they pray together. We have our mosque here in Clemson. The majority of our membership is Sunni, but we also have some Shia brothers and sisters, and they come, they pray with us at the same place. So the difference between Sunnis and Shias is not like the difference between Protestants and Catholics. We fast in the same month, we have the same version of the Quran, it's only one. We don't have different versions, it's only one in the Arabic language, and it has always been the same for about 1500 years. However, in some places where there is a political tension, like in Iraq, for example, Sunnis have their own mosques and Shias have their own mosques because of the conflict for power. But overall, in the great majority of Muslim countries, they pray together and they worship together. Do Muslims hate Christians and Jews? To start with, Muslims don't hate nobody. If you read in the Quran, if you read in the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, all humans are called brothers in the Quran, in the teachings of Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad said, and this is his last speech that he gave a few weeks before his death, he says, oh my kind, your Lord is one, and your father, your ancestry is one. All of you are from Adam, and Adam is from dust. There is neither privilege for an Arab over a non-Arab, nor for a white over a black, except in account of his or her righteousness. There are three different types of brotherhood in Islam. There is the brotherhood in humanity, and this includes everyone in the universe. There is brotherhood in faith, and this includes Muslims. And there is blood brotherhood, your own brother, biological brother. Moses and the children of Israel are oftentimes mentioned in the Quran in many, many chapters. And as a matter of fact, the story of Moses and the children of Israel and his miracles and life are mentioned in 50 chapters of the Quran out of 114. The Torah is said in the Quran in chapter 5 to be revealed as a source of guidance and light. Jesus is mentioned in many places in the Quran. Many Christians don't know that Jesus is mentioned by name in the Quran. He is mentioned by name 27 times, whereas Prophet Muhammad of Islam is mentioned only 4 times by name. The life of Jesus and his miracles are mentioned in detail in many chapters, like 3 and 5 and 9, and there are 3 miracles of Jesus are in the Quran that are not in the Bible. If you read the last couple of pages of chapter 5, you will see all the miracles, including these 3. Chapter 5 says that the gospel of Jesus was revealed as a source of guidance and light. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is the only woman mentioned by name in the Quran. And there is a chapter in the Quran named after her, chapter Mary, chapter number 19, and she is mentioned by name in the Quran more than she is in the Bible. There are, however, some differences between what Muslims believe about Jesus and what Christians believe. And I'm not saying this to offend anyone, but just to let you know what Muslims think of Jesus. He is the Christ. He's called in the Quran the Christ, the Messiah, the Word of God, and the Spirit from God. And we believe that he was born of a virgin. We believe in his teachings and miracles, that he gave life to the dead, he cured the blind, and so on and so forth. And we believe that he ascended to heaven. We believe in his second coming. But we believe he was a prophet, just like Moses and Abraham and David and Muhammad and all the prophets of old. And we believe he was sent exclusively to the Jews. And Jesus himself said this repeatedly in the Bible. If you read in the book of Matthew, he said, "I have been sent only to the lost sheep of the children of Israel." Also in the book of Matthew, he instructed his disciples to teach and preach only to the lost sheep of Israel. And he told them, don't go to the Gentiles and the Samaritans. We don't believe that he died on the cross. However, there was a crucifixion. If you read in the Quran in chapter 5, it says that Jesus was neither crucified nor was he killed. But it was made to appear to the people like this. So this is the Muslim narrative of the crucifixion. Judas Iscariot, just like in the Bible, sold out Jesus for silver coins. When it was time for Jesus to get busted by the Romans, God made Judas Iscariot look like Jesus, so they took Judas Iscariot, put him on the cross, he died. And Jesus was ascended safe and sound to heaven in one piece. Muslims quote the Bible, Book of Mark 15, as a support of this narrative, where the person on the cross cried, "God, God, why have you forsaken me? Or why have you let me down?" So Muslims say, if it was Jesus, he would never say something like this. The way Jesus speaks about himself in the Quran is very similar to what Jesus speaks about himself in the Bible. If you have the King James Version of the Bible, and you read the passages written in red, the words of Jesus in his own words, they pretty much agree with everything that Jesus said about himself in the Quran. That he has limitations. He's a human being. He said, for example, in the book of John, "I of myself can do nothing. What I do is to please God and not to please myself." When he was asked in the book of Mark about his second coming and the final hour, he said, "I don't know. The angels don't know. Only God knows." In one place in the book of Mark, when he invited the disciples to eat from a fig, from the orchard, fig fruit, and when they went there were no figs. They asked him, "What's going on?" He said, "I didn't know that it wasn't the season for the fig trees to bear fruit." He was called the prophet by the people around himself, and he said that he came to preach the belief in one God. Why do Muslims make images of God or Prophet Muhammad? To start with, we haven't seen any of them. We haven't seen God, we haven't seen Prophet Muhammad. So how could we make images of them if we haven't seen them? Number two, this is the most commonly used and adopted picture of Jesus, to the left. Blue eyes, blonde hair, Caucasian, handsome fellow. But if you read the description of Jesus in the Bible, he is described as his skin color is burnt brass and curly hair, which are features of people from the Middle East and Africa. So, technically, I look more American than Jesus because I have blue eyes. But although at the John F. Kennedy Airport when I came to this country 3 years ago, they called me alien, as if I looked green or something. Some black Christians put the image of Jesus as a black Jesus. And if you read about Marcus Garvey, the black nationalist movement back in the 1930s and 40s, he propagated the belief in a black Jesus. And he didn't accept the belief in a white Jesus. The picture at the bottom right is the closest rendition of the way Jesus looked based on the analysis, computer analysis of the Shroud of Turin, which is believed by many to be the shroud in which Jesus was covered when he was crucified. So this is the closest rendition according to the History Channel. Why Muslims don't eat pork or drink alcohol? To start with pork, Christians shouldn't eat it either. Nor should the Jews. The Jews don't eat it anyway. But the Christians, Jesus says in the Bible that he came to uphold the laws of Moses and not to abolish them. And Moses said in the Old Testament that the pork, the pig, is filthy and you shouldn't even touch it. So why do Jews not eat pork? Some Christians don't eat it. Muslims don't eat it. Those who eat it find an excuse in the words of Paul, who says and taught that Jesus, by his ascension, he abolished the laws of Moses. So that's why it's permissible for people to eat it. I don't need to talk much about alcohol and the harm that alcohol causes. Statistically, over 100,000 people die in this country because of things and accidents and crimes related to alcohol. People who die of diseases because of alcohol, people who make accidents under the influence and die. And you have lost some of your colleagues and fellow students because of alcohol in the past years. I've heard some stories about some accidents. Islamic violence. To start with, this is one of the last verses to be revealed of the Quran, talking about how Muslims should treat non-Muslims. But before we go through the translation, you can scan it with your eyes very quick. Does the Quran say kill non-Muslims? Yes. Does the Quran kill non-Muslims? No. Does the Quran say kill Muslims? Yes. Does the Quran say kill non-Muslims? Yes. He's very confused. Here's the thing, and this is what all countries and what all constitutions in the world do. They do the same thing that the Quran says. The Quran says if anyone attacks you, you have the right to fight them and kick them out of your country or your home. If people are at peace with you, you don't have the right to attack them, regardless of their faith. So for example, when Iraqis invaded Kuwait in 1990, did Iraqis have the right to fight them, did Kuwaitis have the right to fight and kick out Iraqis? Yes, but they were Muslims. And many of them were killed, thousands of them were killed, but they invaded somebody else's country. And Americans would do the same thing if their country was attacked or sacked by Mexicans, for example. Anyone would do the same thing. I'm not saying that the Mexicans are bad people, I'm just giving an example. So the verse says, in chapter 60, verse 8 and 9, says that Allah does not forbid you to deal kindly and equitably with non-Muslims who have neither fought against you on account of your faith, nor drove you out of your homes. Indeed, Allah loves those who act with equity. It is only against those who have fought against you and have driven you out of your homes that you should take them as friends and protectors. And God does not like the wrongdoers. So as we said, fighting is only allowed against the invaders, regardless of their faith. And fighting against peaceful people is prohibited in the Quran, regardless of the person's faith. All the verses that talk about violence in the Quran, there are some verses that talk about violence, and you can find them in chapter 2, chapter 9, chapter 8, chapter 47, and chapter 48. If you read any of these chapters, and read any of the verses that talk about violence, they talk about one of these things. Fighting against an invader, or fighting if the peace treaty was violated. If the enemy asks for peace, you give them peace. So these are the three themes that the chapters and verses that talk about violence in the Quran handle. One of these phrases. Fighting in self-defense to make peace if the enemy asks for peace, or you have the right to fight if the peace treaty or the peace truce has been violated or terminated. All the passages that talk about violence in the Quran talk exclusively about the people of Mecca, the pagans of Mecca, who were persecuting Muslims for 13 years before Muslims were allowed to fight back in self-defense. If anyone gives you a verse in the Quran, most of the time when they talk about violence in the Quran or passages that talk about war on Fox or other networks, most of the time they tell you, for example, that the Quran says kill the infidels. But most of the time they don't give you a chapter number or a verse number. If they give you a chapter number or a verse number, you need to go and read the verse and read a couple of verses before and a couple of verses after. And it doesn't say what they make it seem. It says something different, but it is taken out of context and will give a few examples. So the verses should be read within their contextual and historical background to give the meaning, not out of context. This part of the verse in chapter 2 is the most frequently quoted verse from the Quran. Kill them wherever you find them. Kill Americans wherever you find them, at Walmart or buy them. So this is what they say. But if you read the verse from 190 to 192, it doesn't say this. So read from the beginning. Fight in the cause of God only against those who fight you, but don't exceed the limits. And we'll talk about the limits in a minute. For God doesn't like transgressors. Kill them wherever you find them. And by reading the context, and this is what it says in other chapters, kill them wherever you find them in the battlefield. And drive them out of the places from which they have driven you out. He's talking about your home, your country. For spreading mischief is worse than killing. And don't fight them within the precincts of the sacred mosque unless they attack you therein. But if you fight you, then fight them. That is the punishment of the disbelievers. If they cease, then surely God is the most forgiving, most merciful. Before Prophet Muhammad sent out an army to fight against the people of Mecca, he would tell his army, don't kill an old man, don't kill a woman or a child, and don't mutilate dead bodies, but be courteous. I'm not saying that violations have been committed throughout history. You have heard of what the Ottomans did to the people of Armenia. Thousands or hundreds of thousands of people have been killed because of persecution. So the Ottomans were Muslims and the Armenians were Christians, most likely. So violations have been committed. And non-Muslims have been oppressed and persecuted by some Muslims. All I'm saying is there's no, you will never find a verse in the Quran that justifies what they did. But they manipulated the verses, took them out of context to justify the evil they did. Speaking of taking things out of context, just look at the some of the words that Prophet Muhammad says in the Quran. Don't think I came to bring peace on the earth. I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. Actually, I made a mistake. These are not the words of Muhammad. These are the words of Jesus in the Bible, in the book of Matthew 10:34. Let's look at another example by Muhammad in the Quran. As for those enemies of mine who didn't want me to be king over them, bring them under my feet and slaughter them. This is not said by Muhammad, but it was said by Jesus in the book of Luke. Jehovah is a man of war. Jehovah is his name. Not Muhammad, but Moses. What I'm saying is you can take anything out of context. If you go back to these verses in the Bible and put them in context, it doesn't say what people make them say. If you go back, these are just parables, and they didn't mean to go and kill people and to slaughter them. So you should read things in context. What about Islam being spread by the sword? I mentioned at the beginning that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the West, in America, and in the world in general. And I don't think Muslims are at a position to have a sword and force people to accept Islam. Indonesia has the biggest number of Muslims that a country has. And not a single Muslim army has ever been sent to Indonesia. But still, it has more Muslims than all Arab countries. There are at least 20 million Christians who live in the Arab world. If Islam was spread by the sword, why these people have not been converted in the past 1500 years? Yes, some Muslims forced some people to accept Islam, but this is not because of something that the Quran teaches. The Quran says that there be no compulsion in religion, because the truth is distinguishable from falsehood. And the reason this verse was revealed was because some of the people of Medina, which is 250 miles to the north of Mecca, where Prophet Muhammad migrated, some of the local people wanted to force the Christian and Jewish children to accept Islam just like they did. They came to the Prophet and told him, and he told them, there's no compulsion in religion. They are free to choose. As I said, some Muslims throughout history have forced other people to accept Islam. And if someone is forced to accept Islam Islamically, he is not a Muslim. He is not required to pray or fast, because if Islam does not come from the heart, you are not Muslim. Some other faiths have also forced some other people to accept their own faith. Catholics have forced many Protestants to convert to Catholicism. And there have been so many wars, especially in the Middle Ages, between Catholics and Protestants. European Christians also forced some Jews and Christians, some Jews and Muslims, and some Christians of other denominations to convert by force. The Jews of Spain, if you heard of the Court of Inquisition, 1492, the Jews were also, some of them were forced by the Spanish Inquisition to either convert or die, just like Muslims. And you probably heard of African Americans, the millions of them who were transported to this continent. 30% of them were Muslim, and historically, that they were forced to accept Christianity, the faith of the slave master. If someone leaves Islam, should he be killed? There is this disagreement among the scholars of Islam as to if this person should be killed or not. The first opinion is this person should be killed after 3 days. The second opinion is As long as a person who left Islam does not join the enemies and fight against Muslims, he or she should be left free. And the second opinion is supported by the sayings and the actions of Prophet Muhammad. He never killed anyone who left Islam in his time. He only killed those who joined the army of Mecca and fought against Muslims. So the person was killed for treason and not for apostasy. All the verses in the Quran that talk about apostasy, like for example 2:17, say that the punishment in this world for someone who leaves Islam is he or she will give the reward for his or her good deeds invalidated. But the punishment is in the hereafter. If Islam is the fastest growing religion, if I know that Islam, if I for some reason, after conversion, like to leave the religion and the people will kill me if I leave it, I'm not going to accept this faith. So if many people accept the religion, this means that this is not true. Jihad. The word jihad linguistically means to strive or to exert your effort. And technically, jihad means to strive to overcome your desires and lower self. If you want to give in charity, and your buddy, the shaitan, the devil comes to you and says, you're going to go broke if you give in charity. If you go ahead and give in charity, this is called jihad in Islam. If the shaitan is telling you to go and do something bad, drink or do this, and you stop, this is jihad. So to stop doing something evil or to go ahead and do something good, this is called jihad in Islam. The second type is to fight in self-defense. And there are two types of jihad as far as violence is concerned. The obligatory is jihad is when your country is under attack by an enemy. And the second type is the optional one is for a group of people to watch over the borders of their country at the time of peace. We hear all the time about Sharia and Muslims want to take over the country and impose Sharia on the people. So Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck have to grow their beards and Barbara Walters have to wear the hijab or the head cover and all that nonsense. The Sharia is the Islamic law and the Sharia governs the Muslim theology, rulings related to acts of worship, human interactions between Muslims and non-Muslims and between humans in general, business transactions, family relations, marriage, divorce, inheritance, and life in this world and in the next. The Sharia is mostly based on the teachings of the Quran and the sayings and the actions of Prophet Muhammad. When they ask in the media, are Muslims trying to impose the Sharia on Americans? You should ask them back, does the Sharia apply to non-Muslims who live in Muslim lands? So here occurs the question. Is it possible for less than 1% of the population to impose the Sharia on 99%? Ask them, is the Sharia applied to the 7% of Christians in Egypt, for example? And the answer is no. Non-Muslims in Muslim countries have their own laws and their own courts. Especially most of the Muslim countries have secular regimes. They are not theocratic regimes, except for a few countries like the Taliban in Afghanistan, in Iran, mostly in Saudi Arabia. But the rest of the Muslim country is secular. A Muslim, for example, a Muslim woman in Tunisia is not allowed to wear the scarf because there is a secular government. A Muslim woman is not allowed to go to college with a scarf in Turkey because it's a secular society. Does the Sharia apply to Muslims who live in non-Muslim lands? Yes and no. Yes, when it comes to personal things like if you want to pray, if you want to fast, if you want to, you know, personal things, it is permissible. But things related to penal laws, the punishments, the government, the Sharia is not applied. Islam teaches if you live in a non-Muslim country, then the laws and the constitution of this country becomes your own Sharia. As long as this law does not force you to do something that is not permissible in your Sharia. For example, if they force me to eat pork in this country, I ain't gonna eat it because it is against the teachings of my faith. But if the American Constitution tells me to respect the traffic lights, I have to respect it Islamically because it is not against the teachings of Islam. Some people think that the Sharia does not overlap with secular laws in many countries. And actually, there's a lot of overlapping. You cannot separate Islam from any government system or any practices in any country because you are basically saying that Sharia is black, that the laws of this country is white, and they don't overlap. There are so many rulings in the Sharia that in utter agreement with the secular laws in some countries. Was the Quran plagiarized from the Bible? To answer this question, you need to break up the different verses in the Quran. There are more than 6,300 verses in the Quran. And any verse will fall under one of these categories. The first one, stories of the past. And there are 25 prophets that are mentioned by name in the Quran, and most of them are from the Bible. Like Moses and David and Solomon. The second theme is the Muslim ideology. Belief in one God, the acts of worship, rights and obligations, inheritance, and so on and so forth. And number three, the belief in the unseen, the belief in God, the angels, prophets, the day of judgment. It is because of the first theme that Islam was called throughout history, or the Quran was called to be plagiarized from the Bible. But if you get a Quran today and read, for example, the verses that talk about Jesus or Moses or Adam, there are so many differences between the Quranic narrative and the biblical narrative. One example. In the Bible it says that Eve was the one who was tempted to eat from the tree. So she ate and she gave Adam to eat. In the Quran, in chapter 20, it says that Adam was the one who was tempted and he ate from the tree and therefore he is to blame. And I always say that women are to blame for many things, but not for this one. At least from a Quranic perspective. Is the Quran against science? To start with, the Quran is not a book of science. It's a book of science. There are so many verses in the Quran that talk about science. If you got the chance to get a copy of the book, Brief Illustrated Guide of Islam. There are so many scientific facts that are mentioned in the Quran. They have been there for 1500 years. And some of these facts have been discovered in the past century or so. Like the different stages of the development of the embryo in the womb of the mother. It is described precisely in the Quran. Prophet Muhammad couldn't read and he couldn't write. And there are so many verses that talk about the creation, the Big Bang theory, the fact that the earth is sphere and not is sphere and not flat, and so on and so forth. The Quran and Islam prompted a lot of scientific breakthroughs, especially in what they call the Islamic Golden Age. There are so many Muslim scholars who lived back then. They invented algebra and they invented many science like chemistry and Avicenna or Ibn Sina. One of his books, The Canon of Medicine, was taught at European history, European universities for over 500 years. The father of modern surgery, and most of his, Zahrawi, most of his surgical tools are still in use today in modern hospitals. So it is safe to say that the Islamic civilization that existed in the Golden Age was the link between the Greek and the Roman civilizations, and the modern Western civilization. Is Islam oppressive to women? This is my favorite topic. So, put on your seat belts. In Islam, men and women are equal but different. Equal but different. In the same manner, I'm equal to my younger brother, but we're different. He's much taller, he's more handsome, and he has a more beautiful eyes than I. We are equal, but we are different. And if you are 25 years old, and if you haven't figured out that males are different, at least physically, from females, then, by accident, go to the female, if you are a male, go to the female restrooms at Bilo, and you will know the difference after you hear all the screaming, calling 911. They are different. There are so many violations committed against some Muslim women in some countries. But these violations are not because of Islam or the Quran, they are because of the local cultures and tribal habits and traditions. For example, if Afghani women were not allowed to get an education, this is not because of Islam, this is because of the tribal traditions. The Prophet Muhammad says, seeking knowledge is an obligation on every Muslim, male or female. If women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to get a driver's license, it is not because of Islam, it is because of the culture. If women in Egypt, like my mother, couldn't get a share of inheritance from their parents, this is not because of Islam. If you read chapter 4, it gives the different shares of inheritance for women, but it is because of the culture in Egypt, and so on and so forth. Islamically, men and women are equal before God and the law. It is repeated many times in the Quran. They are equal in the rights, they have equal obligations. If they do good deeds, they get the same reward. If they do something evil, they get the same punishment. But they have different roles and different responsibilities because of their physical and psychological makeup. And if you are 25 years old, if you haven't figured out again that men are different from women, after you get married, you are there in the kitchen cooking with your wife, your favorite dish, and all of a sudden there's a mouse or a roach in the kitchen. The lady will jump out of the window, and the man will lay down his life in defense of the house. So there is a difference. To better appreciate what Islam has done to women, we need to think of pre-Islamic cultures. Before Islam, women didn't get a share of inheritance. Islam gave them a share. Women didn't own their property. Islam made them own their property. They didn't have a say in marriage, and Islam gave them this right. Muslim women keep their name at marriage, so they don't drop their last name and get their husband's last name. However, if they choose to, it's up to them, but there's no obligation Islamically to do this. In Egypt, for example, the United Arab Emirates, more females go to college than males. And the percentage in some Arab countries is higher than the percentage of males who go to college in Europe. All I'm saying is what is true for women in one country in the Muslim world is not true for the rest of Muslim women. Let's think about the United States. If you go back in history, a century ago, things have not always been the way they are today. You probably heard of the suffragette movement back in the 1920s and 30s. Women in this country were trying to get the right to vote in this country, 90 years ago. And at that time in Egypt, there were female members of parliament. The recent studies show that for every dollar a man makes in this country, a woman, a white woman, makes 77 cents. African-American women make much less, and Latino women make much, much less. So, you know, there's always this talk about men and women being equal, but in actuality, there are some differences, and women still need to go, you know, more. There is a long way for them to go to be equal with men. I'm not trying to say that they are not equal, but in actuality, in reality, they are not treated the same in this country. I'll give more examples. Back in the 1920s, in places like South Carolina, a woman, regardless of her age, was not allowed to buy a house or take a loan from the bank without the signature of her father or her husband. What am I looking at? Who are those guys? What is very special about this collection of pictures? Who are these people anyway? They are the presidents of the United States. And there's not a single woman in there. For almost 250 years, not a single woman was ever elected president or vice president. But if you look at the Muslim world in the past 10 or 15 years, there have been several women who have been elected either president or vice president or the head of state. In Indonesia, Megawati Soekarno was elected president in the past 10 years. In Pakistan, two women were elected or have been elected vice president, head of state. In Bangladesh, you have in Turkey, a vice president. And many throughout Muslim history have been chosen to lead their countries. So Americans need some more time to be ready to accept a female to lead them. Hear all the talk about the scarf, and the scarf is a sign of oppression. To start with, there are several styles of scarf, and there are so many women in the Muslim world who don't dress in the scarf. The majority of Muslim women dress in the scarf, but there are some who choose not to, or they are not ready yet for this step. The scarf is not an Islamic monopoly. Muslims didn't invent it, so don't give us the credit. If you look at old movies, Jane Austen, if you see movies depicting Jesus and Mary, you will see women in the scarf. So the scarf comes from the Jewish and the Christian traditions. If you read in the book of Corinthians, where Paul says if a woman doesn't cover her hair, she should shave it off because it is disgraceful for a woman to uncover her hair. So when people ask me why should Muslim women dress like this, I ask them why Christian and Jewish women are not dressed like this. This should be the question. The scarf is seen as a sign of modesty in Islam, and the scarf is not the only sign of modesty. Both men and women are required to be decent in the way they speak, the way they talk, the way they behave. So it is not only about the scarf. People say that Islam oppresses women because they get half of the share of males in the family, and this is one of the misconceptions. If you read in chapter 4 of the Quran, women get 3 different shares of inheritance. And a share of inheritance is decided according to the relationship with the deceased, not on the sex of the person. The closer you are to the deceased, the more you will give. So in some cases, a woman, depending on her position in the family, a mother, or a wife, a daughter, a sister, might give half of her brother's share, twice the share, or equal share of inheritance depending on the case. And these are some examples where you see females getting half of the share of men, equal the share in the second example, or twice or more than the share of a male in the family. Like in the last case, for example, if I die, I leave $24,000, And I have my mother, my wife, for sons, two daughters, and my brother. My mother would give 4,000, my wife would give 3,000, my son would give 2,800, my daughter would give 1,600, and my brother, who is a male, would give zero. They say that the Quran says that a woman's testimony is half that of the man. And this is true in only one case. At the signing of a loan, if someone is giving another person a loan, then if there are not two men, then we give one man and two women. And one of the two women would bear witness, the other one would be a backup. But if there is a conflict and somebody needs to go to the court to witness, we accept the testimony of a single person. So the second woman is only a backup, because back then, women didn't actually get involved with business and traveling for business all the time, so two women were required for this. But in the rest of religious rulings, the testimony of a woman equals the testimony of a man. Say, for example, at the beginning of Ramadan, there's the sighting of the new moon, the crescent, so it is required to have one witness to say that I've seen the moon, and therefore all Muslims should fast. 1.6 billion Muslims should fast based on the sighting of one person. Regardless if this person is a man or a woman, both witnesses are accepted. In some cases, in fiqh or jurisprudence, the testimony of women are to be accepted and the testimony of men is to be rejected. We accept only the testimony of women in cases related to women, like pregnancy and virginity and so on and so forth. Polygamy. Yeah, we're almost done. Why a Muslim man is allowed or obligated to have four wives and a Muslim woman is not allowed to have four husbands? It is not fair. To start with, getting more than one wife is only permissible, it is not obligatory. And you should have two conditions to give more than one wife. Number one, if you are physically and financially able to provide for a second wife, and if you treat them equally, it should be just to both of them. Otherwise, it is not permissible to have a second wife Islamically. Muslims are not the only people who practice polygamy. So don't give us the credit for it. David, according to the Bible, had many, many wives. And as a matter of fact, all the biblical prophets, with the exception of Jesus Christ and John the Baptist, had more than one wife. So let me say it again so the people with PhDs in the room can understand. All the biblical prophets, with the exception of Jesus Christ and John the Baptist, had more than one wife. David had many wives. Solomon broke records. He had 700 wives. And so on and so forth. Abraham and all of them. In Islam, polygamy is recommended for humanitarian purposes. Especially after wars, most of the time, men go to battle, lay down their lives to protect their countries and their homes, and women stay in the house chatting on Facebook. So many men lose their lives and you have more women, so Islamically it is recommended for someone to marry another woman, especially widows, to care for her and her family. Islam is the only religion that puts limit on marriage. In the Quran in chapter 4, it says, marry only one up to four. So Islam is the only religion that says one up to four. In other faiths, there's no limit. And you can go to chapter 4, verse 3, and it gives the conditions for marrying a second wife. Marry women of your choice, two or three or four. But if you fear that you should not be able to deal justly with them, then marry only one. This is closer to justice. These days, polygamy is only practiced in the Gulf states, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Bahrain. But in the majority of the Muslim world, especially in the Southeast Asia, North Africa, if you tell your wife that you're going to marry a second wife, this is going to be the last day of your life. Seriously. Muslims are probably the most monogamous people in the world because I'd say 99% of Muslim men know only one woman in their lives, and this is their wife. And 99% of Muslim women know only one man in their lives, and this is their husbands. Because dating and premarital and extramarital relationships are not permissible in Islam. Just think about it. At least from a wife's perspective, it is more honorable for a husband to have a second wife than to have a mistress or a girlfriend. At least your wife is going to be more merciful to you when she kills you because of getting a second wife than to have a girlfriend. So instead of putting 5 bullets in your head, she's going to put only 3. There are some countries that have more women, more females than males. In the 2000 census in the U.S., there were 5,500,000 more women than men in this country. And the same is also true for many countries. I'm not saying this is true for all countries, but there are several countries or many countries that have more females than males. Okay, men tend to be more polygamous than women. Statistically, according to the American Chronicle, 50 to 60 married men in America cheat on their wives. And the percentage of women, wives who cheat on their husbands is much less. According to the Justice Department, a woman is raped in America every 2 minutes. And I personally haven't heard of a man who has been raped by a woman. According to the 2004 ABC News poll, the women who were surveyed say they have an average of 6 partners in their lifetime, whereas men reported to have 20 partners in their adult life. You probably heard of someone who is married and he's got busted sneaking around, cheating on his wife. Politicians, Bill Clinton, Spitzer, John Edwards, he actually made a video of his relationship. And he left it when he left the house. And his secretary is blackmailing him. Rudy Giuliani, clergy, Jimmy Swaggart, Jim Backer, Ted Haggard, and you probably heard of Catholic priests who have sexually abused children. David Letterman, who confessed that he had relationships with female producers in his program, the directors, and most of the female audience in the studio. Tiger Woods. So I haven't heard a lot of celebrity women who get busted cheating on their husbands. They exist, but they are not as many as men because, as I said, statistically, men tend to be more polygamous than women. Why do the misconceptions persist? Number one, because of the media. They don't invite scholars to speak. If they want to speak about pharmacology, they invite a plumber to speak about pharmacology. And this is what happens with Islam. They invite some anti-Islam bigots to speak about Islam, or former Muslims to speak about Islam. So imagine inviting a former Christian to speak about Christianity, and they're not going to say good stuff. So all you need to do is read for yourself. Don't take anybody's word for any religion, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, or any faith. You are intelligent enough to read and think for yourself. Number two, when people generalize about a whole ethnicity or religion just because of the actions of a foolish, irresponsible few. I don't think it is fair to generalize about all Americans because of the action of Timothy McVeigh, or to generalize about Christianity because of the actions of the Ku Klux Klan. If you read about what they did back in the 1950s and 60s to black people, or to generalize about all Jews because of the crime that Yigal Amir committed in 1995 when he assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. So why should we do the same thing about Muslims? Ignorance. Most of us don't know much about other people, and as a matter of fact, one of the most recent surveys and polls by, I don't remember, Gallup or Pew Research Center, says that most Americans don't know much about their own faith. Forget about other people's faith. Like most Protestants, for example, didn't, 56% of Protestants didn't know who Martin Luther was. They didn't know that he was the founder of the Protestant church. And there were so many examples. We have so many idiots in the Muslim world who don't know much about the West, who don't know much about America, and they think that all American men are violent or drunkards or criminals, and they think that most American women are loose. And this is because what they see in Hollywood movies. This is what they see all the time. So all you need to do is read for yourself and not to prejudge people because of the actions of a few. And I conclude with this quotation from John Kennedy. He said it in 1961 at his inauguration, and I still remember it as if he said it this morning. He said, "Ask not, and so my fellow Americans, ask not what Fox News can teach you about Islam, ask what you yourself can teach or can learn about this religion." And he said it. I'm not making this up. Thank you. If you have any questions.